Chapter 6. The deliberations conducted in London have a far-reaching importance, and so the decision issued from the fog-veiled offices of the Borneo Company darkened for Almayer the brilliant sunshine of the tropics, and added another drop of bitterness to the cup of his disenchantments. The claim to that part of the East Coast was abandoned, leaving the Pantai River under the nominal power of Holland. In Sambor there was joy and excitement. The slaves were hurried out of sight into the forest and jungle, and the flags were run up to tall poles, in the Rajah's compound in expectation of a visit from Dutch man-of-war boats. The frigate remained anchored outside the mouth of the river, and the boats came up in tow of the steam launch, threading their way cautiously amongst a crowd of canoes filled with gaily dressed Malays. The officer in command listened gravely to the loyal speeches of Lakamba, returned the salams of Abdullah, and assured those gentlemen in choice Malay of the great Rajah's down in Batavia friendship and goodwill towards the ruler and inhabitants of this model state of Sambor. Almayer from his veranda watched across the river the festive proceedings, heard the report of brass guns saluting the new flag presented to Lakamba, and the deep murmur of the crowd of spectators surging round the stockade. The smoke of the firing rose in white clouds on the green background of the forests, and he could not help comparing his own fleeting hopes to the rapidly disappearing vapor. He was by no means patriotically elated by the event, yet he had to force himself into a gracious behavior when, the official reception being over, the naval officers of the commission crossed the river to pay a visit to the solitary white man of whom they had heard, no doubt wishing also to catch a glimpse of his daughter. In that they were disappointed, Nina refusing to show herself. But they seemed easily consoled by the gin, and cheroots set before them by the hospitable Almayer, and sprawling comfortably on the lame armchairs under the shade of the veranda, while the blazing sunshine outside seemed to set the great river simmering in the heat, they filled the little bungalow with the unusual sounds of European languages, with noise and laughter produced by naval witticisms at the expense of the fat Lakamba whom they had been complimenting so much that very morning. The younger men in an access of good fellowship made their host talk, and Almayer, excited by the sight of European faces, by the sound of European voices, opened his heart before the sympathizing strangers, unaware of the amusement the recital of his many misfortunes caused to those future admirals. They drank his health, wished him many big diamonds and a mountain of gold, expressed even an envy of the high destinies awaiting him yet. Encouraged by so much friendliness, the gray-headed and foolish dreamer invited his guests to visit his new house. They went there through the long grass in a straggling procession, while their boats were got ready for the return down the river in the cool of the evening. And in the great empty rooms, where the tepid wind entering through the sashless windows whirled gently the dried leaves, and the dust of many days of neglect, Almayer in his white jacket and flowered sarong, surrounded by a circle of glittering uniforms, stamped his foot to show the solidity of the neatly fitting floors, and expatiated upon the beauties and convenience of the building. They listened and assented, amazed by the wonderful simplicity and the foolish hopefulness of the man, till Almayer, carried away by his excitement, disclosed his regret at the non-arrival of the English, who knew how to develop a rich country, as he expressed it. There was a general laugh amongst the Dutch officers at that unsophisticated statement, and a move was made towards the boats. But when Almayer, stepping cautiously on the rotten boards of the Lingard jetty, tried to approach the chief of the commission with some timid hints anent the protection required by the Dutch subject against the wily Arabs, that saltwater diplomat told him significantly that the Arabs were better subjects than Hollanders who dealt illegally in gunpowder with the Malays. The innocent Almayer recognized there at once the oily tongue of Abdullah, and the solemn persuasiveness of Lakamba, but ere he had time to frame an indignant protest the steam launch, and the string of boats moved rapidly down the river leaving him on the jetty, standing open-mouthed in his surprise and anger. There are 30 miles of river from Samber to the gem-like islands of the estuary, where the frigate was awaiting the return of the boats. The moon rose long before the boats had traversed half that distance, and the Black Forest, sleeping peacefully under her cold rays, woke up that night to the ringing laughter in the small flotilla provoked by some reminiscence of Almayer's lamentable narrative. Saltwater jests at the poor man's expense were passed from boat to boat. The non-appearance of his daughter was commented upon with severe displeasure, and the half-finished house built for the reception of Englishmen received on that joyous night the name of Almayer's Folly by the unanimous vote of the light-hearted seamen. For many weeks after this visit, life in Samber resumed its even and uneventful flow. Each day's sun shooting its morning rays above the treetops lit up the usual scene of daily activity. Nina, walking on the path that formed the only street in the settlement, saw the accustomed sight of men lolling on the shady side of the houses, on the high platforms, of women busily engaged in husking the daily rice, of naked brown children racing along the shady and narrow paths leading to the clearings. Jim Eng, strolling before his house, greeted her with a friendly nod, before climbing up indoors, to seek his beloved opium pipe. The elder children clustered round her, daring from long acquaintance, pulling the skirts of her white robe with their dark fingers, and showing their brilliant teeth in expectation of a shower of glass beads. She greeted them with a quiet smile, but always had a few friendly words for a Siamese girl, a slave owned by Bulangi, whose numerous wives were said to be of a violent temper. Well-founded rumor said also that the domestic squabbles of that industrious cultivator ended generally in a combined assault of all his wives upon the Siamese slave. The girl herself never complained, perhaps from dictates of prudence, but more likely through the strange, resigned apathy of half-savage womankind. From early morning she was to be seen on the paths amongst the houses by the riverside, or on the jetties, the tray of pastry it was her mission to sell, skillfully balanced on her head. During the great heat of the day she usually sought refuge in Almayer's campong, often finding shelter in a shady corner of the veranda, where she squatted with her tray before her, when invited by Nina. For M. Putes he had always a smile, but the presence of Mrs. Almayer, the very sound of her shrill voice, was the signal for a hurried departure. To this girl Nina often spoke. The other inhabitants of Samber seldom, or never heard the sound of her voice. They got used to the silent figure moving in their midst, calm and white-robed, a being from another world and incomprehensible to them. Yet Nina's life, for all her outward composure, for all the seeming detachment from the things and people surrounding her, was far from quiet, in consequence of Mrs. Almayer being much too active for the happiness and even safety of the household. As he had resumed some intercourse with Lacamba, not personally, it is true, for the dignity of that potentate kept him inside his stockade, but through the agency of that potentate's prime minister, harbor master, financial advisor, and general factotum. That gentleman of Sulu origin was certainly endowed with statesmanlike qualities, although he was totally devoid of personal charms. In truth, he was perfectly repulsive, possessing only one eye and a pockmarked face, with nose and lips horribly disfigured by the smallpox. This unengaging individual often strolled into Almayer's garden in an official costume, composed of a piece of pink calico round his waist. There at the back of the house, squatting on his heels on scattered embers, in close proximity to the great iron boiler, where the family daily rice was being cooked by the women under Mrs. Almayer's superintendence, did that astute negotiator carry on long conversations in Sulu language with Almayer's wife. What the subject of their discourses was might have been guessed from the subsequent domestic scenes by Almayer's hearthstone. Of late Almayer had taken two excursions up the river, in a small canoe with two paddlers, and the faithful ally for a steersman he would disappear for a few days at a time. All his movements were no doubt closely watched by Lakamba and Abdullah, for the man, once in the confidence of Rajalot, was supposed to be in possession of valuable secrets. The coast population of Borneo believes implicitly in diamonds of fabulous value, in gold mines of enormous richness in the interior. And all those imaginings are heightened by the difficulty of penetrating far inland, especially on the northeast coast, where the Malays and the river tribes of Dayaks or headhunters are eternally quarreling. It is true enough that some gold reaches the coast in the hands of those Dayaks when, during short periods of truce in the desultory warfare, they visit the coast settlements of Malays. And so the wildest exaggerations are built up, and added to on the slight basis of that fact. Almayer, in his quality of white man, has lingered before him at somewhat better relations with the upriver tribes. Yet even his excursions were not without danger, and his returns were eagerly looked for by the impatient Lakamba. But every time the Raja was disappointed. Vain were the conferences by the rice pot of his factotum Babalichai with the white man's wife. The white man himself was impenetrable to persuasion, coaxing, abuse, to soft words and shrill revilings, to desperate beseechings or murderous threats. For Mrs. Almayer, in her extreme desire to persuade her husband into an alliance with Lakamba, played upon the whole gamut of passion. With her soiled robe wound tightly under the armpits across her lean bosom, her scant grayish hair tumbled in disorder over her projecting cheekbones, in suppliant attitude, she depicted with shrill volubility the advantages of close union with a man so good, and so fair dealing. "Why don't you go to the Raja?" she screamed. "Why do you go back to those Dayaks, in the great forest? They should be killed. You cannot kill them, you cannot, but our Raja's men are brave. You tell the Raja where the old white man's treasure is. Our Raja is good. He is our very grandfather, Dadu Beser. He will kill those wretched Dayaks, and you shall have half the treasure. Oh, Casper, tell where the treasure is. Tell me. Tell me out of the old man's surat, where you read so often at night." On those occasions Almayer sat with rounded shoulders bending to the blast of this domestic tempest, accentuating only each pause in the torrent of his wife's eloquence by an angry growl, "There is no treasure. Go away, woman." Exasperated by the sight of his patiently bent back, she would at last walk round so as to face him across the table, and clasping her robe with one hand, she stretched the other lean arm and claw-like hand to emphasize, in a passion of anger and contempt, the rapid rush of scathing remarks and bitter cursings heaped on the head of the man unworthy to associate with brave Malay chiefs. It ended generally by Almayer rising slowly, his long pipe in hand, his face set into a look of inward pain, and walking away in silence. He descended the steps and plunged into the long grass on his way to the solitude of his new house, dragging his feet in a state of physical collapse from disgust and fear before that fury. She followed to the head of the steps, and sent the shafts of indiscriminate abuse after the retreating form. And each of those scenes was concluded by a piercing shriek, reaching him far away. "Uno, Casper, I am your wife. Your own Christian wife after your own blanda law." For she knew that this was the bitterest thing of all, the greatest regret of that man's life. All these scenes Nina witnessed unmoved. She might have been deaf, dumb, without any feeling as far as any expression of opinion went. Yet oft when her father had sought the refuge of the great moldy rooms of Lemayor's folly, and her mother, exhausted by rhetorical efforts, squatted wearily on her heels with her back against the leg of the table, Nina would approach her curiously, guarding her skirts from Betelgeuse besprinkling the floor, and gaze down upon her as one might look into the quiescent crater of a volcano after a destructive eruption. Mrs. Almayer's thoughts, after these scenes, were usually turned into a channel of childhood reminiscences, and she gave them utterance in a kind of monotonous recitative slightly disconnected, but generally describing the glories of the Sultan of Sulu, his great splendor, his power, his great prowess, The fear which benumbed the hearts of white men at the sight of his swift piratical prowess. And these muttered statements of her grandfather's might were mixed up with bits of later recollections, where the great fight with the High Devil's Brig and the convent life in Samarang occupied the principal place. At that point she usually dropped the thread of her narrative, and pulling out the little brass cross, always suspended round her neck, she contemplated it with superstitious awe. That superstitious feeling connected with some vague talismanic properties of the little bit of metal, and the still more hazy but terrible notion of some bad jinns and horrible torments invented, as she thought, for her special punishment by the good Mother Superior in case of the loss of the above charm, were Mrs. Almayer's only theological luggage for the stormy road of life. Mrs. Almayer had at least something tangible to cling to, but Nina, brought up under the Protestant wing of the proper Mrs. Vink, had not even a little piece of brass to remind her of past teaching. And listening to the recital of those savage glories, those barbarous fights and savage feasting, to the story of deeds valorous, albeit somewhat bloodthirsty, where men of her mother's race shone far above the Orang Blanda, she felt herself irresistibly fascinated, and saw with vague surprise the narrow mantle of civilized morality, in which good-meaning people had wrapped her young soul, fall away and leave her shivering and helpless, as if on the edge of some deep and unknown abyss. Strangest of all, this abyss did not frighten her when she was under the influence of the witch-like being she called her mother. She seemed to have forgotten in civilized surroundings her life before the time when Lingard had, so to speak, kidnapped her from Brow. Since then, as he had had Christian teaching, social education, and a good glimpse of civilized life. Unfortunately, her teachers did not understand her nature, and the education ended in a scene of humiliation, in an outburst of contempt from white people for her mixed blood. As he had tasted the whole bitterness of it, and remembered distinctly that the virtuous Mrs. Vink's indignation was not so much directed against the young man from the bank, as against the innocent cause of that young man's infatuation. And there was also no doubt in her mind that the principal cause of Mrs. Vink's indignation was the thought that such a thing should happen in a white nest, where her snow-white doves, the two Mrs. Vink, had just returned from Europe, to find shelter under the maternal wing, and there await the coming of irreproachable men of their destiny. Not even the thought of the money so painfully scraped together by Almayer, and so punctually sent for Nina's expenses, could dissuade Mrs. Vink from her virtuous resolve. Nina was sent away, and in truth the girl herself wanted to go, although a little frightened by the impending change. And now, as he had lived on the river for 3 years with a savage mother, and a father walking about amongst pitfalls, with his head in the clouds, weak, irresolute, and unhappy, as he had lived a life devoid of all the decencies of civilization, in miserable domestic conditions, as he had breathed in the atmosphere of sordid plottings for gain, of the no less disgusting intrigues, and crimes for lust or money, and those things, together with the domestic quarrels, were the only events of her 3 years' existence. She did not die from despair and disgust the first month, as she expected, and almost hoped for. On the contrary, at the end of half a year it had seemed to her that as he had known no other life. Her young mind having been unskillfully permitted to glance at better things, and then thrown back again into the hopeless quagmire of barbarism, full of strong and uncontrolled passions, had lost the power to discriminate. It seemed to Nina that there was no change and no difference. Whether they traded in brick godowns, or on the muddy river bank, whether they reached after much or little, whether they made love under the shadows of the great trees or in the shadow of the cathedral on the Singapore promenade, whether they plotted for their own ends under the protection of laws and according to the rules of Christian conduct, or whether they sought the gratification of their desires with the savage cunning and the unrestrained fierceness of natures as innocent of culture as their own immense and gloomy forests, Nina saw only the same manifestations of love and hate, and of sordid greed chasing the uncertain dollar in all its multifarious and vanishing shapes. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.